Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the most important painting in history, and how has it survived centuries of criminal activity? When Flemish master Jan van Eyck completed what is known as the Ghent Altarpiece in 1432, the giant polyptych was immediately recognized as a landmark achievement for both its extraordinarily realistic detail and its breakthrough use of the emerging medium of oil paint. It was hung in the church now known as the Cathedral of St. Bavo in Ghent, Belgium, and visited by artists throughout the Old World. But as my guest today will tell us, the altarpiece wouldn't remain there in perpetuity, and in fact is at least as famous today for its unmatched status as a target of crime as for its exquisite artistry. Noah Charney is founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, the true story of the world's most coveted masterpiece. Noah, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
What makes the Ghent altarpiece a fair contender for world's most important painting?
Well, it's a good target for superlatives. In fact, Jan van Eyck, and with the Ghent altarpiece in particular, represents a great deal of art historical firsts. To begin with, it's the first monumental work in oil paints, which would become the preferred medium for painters for the next 500 years. And it was a source of pilgrimage, a site of pilgrimage for artists traveling throughout Europe, because it was the most famous painting in Europe from the moment it was completed in 1432 and for decades onwards. So it influenced every painter for the next few centuries and became the preferred medium for artists throughout Europe. It's also considered the first great painting of the Renaissance. It has elements of medieval Gothic painting and elements of Renaissance painting, including some incredible degree of naturalism that suggests to many people that it was a forerunner for the realist movement. So in a sense, both at a microscopic scale in terms of the realism in the painting, in a technical sense in terms of the oil painting, and in a sense of the greatness of the work itself and its content and its monumentality, it's a very important painting indeed.
We do have a link to the Wikipedia page of this piece of work so that people can check it out. That's on the Think page of KERA.org. But in the meantime, will you describe it for us?
Sure. It's an enormous triptych. It consists of 12 oaken panels, a number of which are painted on both sides, and so the triptych can be opened and closed, and it would be closed during the week, and on Sundays and holidays it would be opened. Each of the 12 panels is made of oak and is about the size of a person standing up, so it's absolutely enormous. It's 14.5 by 11.5 feet, and it weighs about 2 tons, which makes the fact that it's disappeared on so many occasions particularly miraculous.
And what was so amazing about oil paint as compared with, I guess it was tempera, which is an egg-based medium before
that? That's right. Before the Ghent altarpiece, the preferred medium was egg-based tempera, wherein you literally grind pigments and you dip your paintbrush in egg yolk, and that is the binder that fixes the pigment to the canvas or the panel. And in oil paints, which were invented perhaps as early as the 11th century, perhaps even earlier, combines linseed oil and nut oils as the binder. And this allows for a great deal more subtlety because smaller brushes could be used. The paint is thinner and is more translucent. So with tempera paint, if you paint over a portion of a canvas that you've already painted on, it essentially blots out what's beneath. But with oil paint, each layer adds texture to the one beneath it, and you can see the layers beneath glancing through. And as a result, it allowed for an incredible amount of detail in terms of microscopic details that were first painted in the Ghent altarpiece, like the effect of water seen through glass, or the light reflecting in a horse's eye, or by botanically identifiable plants. But at the same time, it allowed for a texture, a layering of paints that had never before been seen.
Why do we know more about Jan van Eyck's life than a lot of his contemporaries?
Well, Jan van Eyck was a celebrity in his own lifetime, and it was very unusual for an artist to be renowned and given more respect than the respect due to a craftsman like a cobbler or a carpenter. Up until around the second half of the 16th century, artists were not given a distinct status the way we think of them as almost the elite of the artisan class. And Jan van Eyck was particular because he was a courtier in the court of Philip the Good, who was the Duke of Burgundy, and he was a very important friend and confidant of the Duke. And he served, actually, as a secret agent. He went on a number of secret missions on behalf of the Duke of Burgundy, of which not too much archival material remains. As with all good secret agency and spy activity, the better you are at it, the less of a trace you leave. But there are indications that he went on a series of secret missions for the Duke of Burgundy to Portugal, probably to the Holy Land, perhaps to Italy. And so we can think of him as something of a Renaissance James Bond, both spy, courtier and political aide, and a magnificent painter.
So is there anything special hidden in the images in the Ghent altarpiece?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and actually the purported answer to that question would lead to two of the thefts of the Ghent altarpiece, mm-hmm. both in 1934 and then ultimately the theft by Hitler during the Second World War. Hitler, like a lot of the Nazi elite, firmly believed in the occult and the supernatural. And the concept that we think of when we think of the Indiana Jones films was actually real. There was a Nazi research organization called the Achtenerb that had teams dedicated to searching for the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant in order to advance the Nazi cause. And so one of the theories posits that there is a coded treasure map in the Ghent altarpiece that is supposed to be a map to the so-called Arma Christi, which are the implements used at Christ's Passion. And Hitler believed that these would grant supernatural powers to the possessor. And one theory about the 1934 theft of one of the 12 panels of the Ghent altarpiece was that the thief was trying to prevent the Nazis from stealing the entire altarpiece and thereby having the completed map. So it's an intriguing conspiracy theory, and knowing what we do about Hitler and the fact that even the Nazi organization began as an occult fraternity before it was a political group, it's entirely plausible.
So the Nazis got their hands on it in 1942,
mm-hmm.
and hid it away in salt mines.
They did. It's an amazing story, and once again it recalls a James Bond film. They converted a underground secret salt mine at a place called Altdossi in the Austrian Alps, and converted it into an incredibly high-tech, humidity-controlled warehouse containing around 7,000 of the most important works of art stolen from Nazi-occupied Europe. And this included the Ghent altarpiece. It seems to have included the Mona Lisa, Leonardo's Lady with an Ermine, works by Vermeer, Titian, Rembrandt, you name it. And these works were destined for Hitler's planned super museum. He had an idea to convert his boyhood city of Linz, Austria, into a citywide museum with every important work of art in the world. And the Ghent altarpiece was going to be the centerpiece of that museum. And so the ERR, which was the Nazi art theft unit, stole the Ghent altarpiece, actually on behalf of Hermann Göring, who the Nazi second-in-command, who was competing with Hitler throughout the Second World War to try to reach certain works of art that each one wanted to have for themselves, and there was a bit of a race between them. And Göring ordered one of the thefts of the Ghent altarpiece from a chateau in Pau in the south of France, where it had been sent for safekeeping. And then it wound its way to this secret storage facility in Altdossi. And part of my story is the absolutely incredible race to rescue the Ghent altarpiece and the 7,000 other masterpieces from destruction at the hands of the local SS officer in charge of the mine, who was determined to blow up all of the mine's treasures against Hitler's direct order if he was unable to defend them against the Allies.
Yeah, so the idea was that this guy would rather have seen these works destroyed than turn them over.
Absolutely. He was a very ruthless Gauleiter called August Eygruber, and he was a personal friend of Hitler's. He was in charge of the Oberdurnau region, which is around Salzburg and where the Altdossi salt mine was located. And he had received a direct order from Hitler's secretary, Martin Bormann, explaining that the mine was to be sealed, but the works were to be protected inside if it looked like they couldn't be defended against the Allies. But Eygruber decided to ignore these orders, and he actually had explosive planted in all of the rooms in the storage facility inside the mine and had intended to detonate them. But there's an incredible story of heroism on the part of a group of Austrian miners working for the resistance, some of the mine's technical directors, two very fortunate and clever allied art detectives with the Monuments and Fine Arts Unit, and an Austrian commando double agent leading a team to try to delay the destruction of the mine. And, of course, they won out in the end, but just by a hair's breadth.
It's pretty extraordinary the kind of coordination that must have taken.
Absolutely. What was interesting about the rescue effort was that the groups seemed to have been working independently of each other and weren't, in fact, aware of the activities of the others. So we had essentially three separate fronts, if you will, to try to protect this incredible treasure house. On the one hand, the two Allied Monuments officers, Robert Posey and Lincoln Kirstein. And Lincoln Kirstein, of course, was very famous in his own right for founding the Metropolitan Ballet. These two Monuments officers were trying to trace the path of these stolen works of art without really knowing about Hitler's planned super museum until rather late in the war effort. And they only learned about it thanks to a reformed SS officer who was in hiding in Germany towards the end of the war called Hermann Bunyes, who told them about literally dozens of monasteries, castles, and salt mines that contained treasure houses of stolen Nazi money, documents, military paraphernalia, and, of course, above all, art. And they weren't aware of the commando mission with the Austrian double agent and his team. And the Austrian double agent seems to have been working independently from a group of Austrian miners working for the resistance who were actually residents of the area around Altasi and whose families had worked in the mine for centuries.
So when they got it out of the salt mines, what sort of condition was it in?
It was actually in relatively good condition. And one thing to keep in mind is these works of art were really built to last. All natural ingredients, of course, mm-hmm. no chemicals, but they protect themselves against the elements to an exceptional degree. And so that a work of art that is a painting on oak panel like this should survive if it is not subject to all of these misadventures. That's one thing, and they really do last beautifully. But the fact that this was involved in 13 different crimes in which this one painting was the object, including having been stolen 7 different times and not always in the best of conditions, it means it's particularly remarkable that it did survive in good condition. And one of the reasons for this was that it always was treasured and prized by the people who stole it. And the Nazis actually had a very elaborate conservation team working on objects that they had stolen. They would go to the castle of Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, and they would be restored there and then sent on to these salt mines for storage. And there was someone who was one of the better members of the Nazi party who was trying to do the best he could to preserve all of the art that the Nazis had stolen. He actually had one panel of the Ghent altarpiece in his conservation studio at the time that the Allies reached the Altasi salt mine. And so the painting was in remarkably good condition, and it is incredibly vibrant and can be seen even today.
Let's talk about the origins of the work for a minute. The sort of scandal surrounding this started even before the time it was completed. Can you talk a little bit about how it was commissioned?
Yes, there's an initial mystery surrounding the Ghent altarpiece that has baffled scholars, and that has to do with the possible addition of a second artist who painted it. Everyone knows about Jan van Eyck, the most important painter of the early part of the Renaissance in Northern Europe. But in 1823, after some of the panels from the altarpiece were stolen at first by a renegade vicar who sold them to an unscrupulous Brussels art dealer, who sold them to a Berlin collector, who sold them to the King of Prussia, who was trying to create a royal collection to outdo the Louvre, the works eventually ended up in Berlin in a museum.
Let me hear you pause there because we're taking a quick break and I want to make sure we get the whole story.
Sure, of course.
Noah Charney is with us. He's founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, the true story of the world's most coveted masterpiece. We will resume our discussion with Noah in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to call us, you can join us on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Noah Charney, founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, the true story of the world's most coveted masterpiece. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Noah, in 1823, some panels of the Ghent altarpiece have found their way to the Kaiser Friedrich Museum in Berlin.
That's right. And there they were cleaned for the first time. And there a remarkable thing happened. An inscription was discovered that looked to be from the 16th century on the back of one of the panels. And it said that the work had been created first by someone called Hubert van Eyck, who was called the first in art, and it was finished by his brother Jan van Eyck. And this sent shockwaves through the art history world because all of a sudden they had this new great master who, according to the inscription, was greater still than Jan van Eyck, and yet they had never heard of him before, and there was not a single painting in the world that was definitively attributed to him. And this sent the sort of shockwaves that would have happened if an inscription had been uncovered on Leonardo's Last Supper stating that the painting was begun by, I don't know, Larry da Vinci, or that the Michelangelo Sistine Chapel had been also painted by Frank Buonarroti. It was that much of a shock. And so art historians looked for works that might be by this mysterious Hubert van Eyck. And still to this day, there's not a single definitively attributed work given to Hubert. And so the question is this the most famous painter who may have never actually painted? And thanks to some archival research, we found that in at least 3 years, 1424, 25, and 26, someone called Hubert van Eyck was working in Ghent and was working as a painter, had a painter's studio. So there was a painter of that name working during the early part of the painting of the Ghent altarpiece. Most people believe it was begun in 1426, but it wasn't finished until 1432. And what seems to be the case is that indeed Hubert van Eyck was commissioned to paint the Ghent altarpiece by Jos Veit, who's the fellow who paid for the altarpiece to be painted, but that he died too soon after the commission to have a visible hand in what we see today. He died in 1426, the year that most people believe the painting was begun. So it was taken over by his brother Jan, and what we see today is Jan's handiwork. But it did spark a hot debate, and there are some who think that this was a 16th century forgery, this inscription, and some people think that Hubert van Eyck is a great artist who hasn't been given his due.
It's hard to imagine that there would be two people with the level of talent that Jan van Eyck had.
Well, actually, van Eyck had a number of relatives who were also formidable painters, and it wasn't all that unusual for family members to share in their artistic skill and also share in their training, particularly if a father or parent was an artist themselves. Jan van Eyck had some siblings, someone called Lambert, someone called Bartholomew, and perhaps even his sister, who were also painters at the time. So it's certainly possible, but it's an intriguing mystery. And still to this day, about half the guidebooks or art history books that you read say that the Ghent altarpiece is by Jan van Eyck alone, and half say that it's by the van Eyck brothers. So it still divides scholars even today.
And is it true that you named your dog Hubert van Eyck?
I do. He's adorable. He's a little Peruvian hairless, and I like the idea that Hubert van Eyck was reincarnated in such an unusual form.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Hi. I'm curious to know, recently many historians argue that many of our greatest Renaissance painters used optical devices to create their works. And like Caravaggio is an example of that. And with these revelations, I'm curious to know how your guest thinks our view of these masterpieces, and I don't know if Van Eyck used optical devices like a camera obscura, but how our view of these masterpieces could change given that they might have been traced. Thank you.
Thanks, Virgo.
Well, it's an interesting question, and that has been a hot point of debate, particularly since David Hockney's book came out about the use of the camera obscura. As far as we can tell, Van Eyck did not use this device, and Caravaggio probably didn't either. Vermeer may have been one of the earliest painters to use it, and it wasn't really used with regularity until you get to neoclassical period, and Ingres in particular was using it quite regularly. It does create a projection of the general outlines of the subject, but all of the details within the subject, all of the painting, all of the shades, Those you need to do yourself. And so while it's a quick way to get the general lines down, it essentially suffices to create the underdrawing, and the rest of it is up to the hand of the artist. So it did cause a scandal when this information first came to light that these great artists were using this material, but it only got them maybe 10-15% of the way through to the completed work of art. So the artistic skill required to complete it is really of the highest level. And in this case, there's no indication that Jan van Eyck used any specific material. It wasn't really until Albrecht Dürer wrote a treatise on some of these techniques that was published about 50 years after van Eyck died that it became more popular, more frequently used. But in this case, I don't think it's part of the equation.
So, Noah, the painting as it exists today hangs once again in the Cathedral of Bavo, but in fact, the first part of it to go missing has been gone since the late 1500s.
Yes. In fact, it had a predella, which is, I often describe it to my students as it looks a bit like a comic strip that runs along the bottom of the altarpiece of a triptych. And it contains little squares with scenes usually related to the life of the saints depicted in the altarpiece above. And that was, in fact, subject to a very bad attempt at restoration very early on, as early as 50 to 75 years after the altarpiece was completed. And it was so badly mangled by the people who tried to restore it, who were at the time artists themselves, that it was eventually discarded. We don't know if it was literally destroyed or simply misplaced. So it may be out there, it may resurface at some point. That's always the hope for lost art. But from that point on, the altarpiece has not been completely intact.
And the cleaning that was required, was that because buildings and churches in particular were sooty places?
They were sooty places. In particular, we tend not to think of this now, but of course, the only way that you would have ever seen a work of art in a church would have been by natural light or by candle or torchlight. And we go to museums today, and we assume that everyone would have seen works of art with this great neon lights that make it very easy to see the details of the work, when in fact, particularly in shadowy churches, it can be very difficult to see these works of art. And whenever I take students, for instance, to a church in Rome when I teach art history, I always ask them to look at the works of art without turning the lights on first to see what it would look like. Well, people wouldn't have seen the details that the Ghent altarpiece offers without some sort of lighting system, so they would have used candles. And candles and torches create soot, and the soot was most dramatically exemplified, for instance, in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo, which was so dirty that when it was cleaned, it looked like all of a sudden this explosion of neon colors, and it looked almost unnaturally bright to people who were used to seeing it covered with centuries of soot. So the Ghent altarpiece was subject to that. There was also a fire in the Cathedral of St. Bavon that damaged the Ghent altarpiece, and it needed to be cleaned for that reason. So it is particularly miraculous that it survived some of the conservation efforts, because before really the Second World War, conservators were called restorers, and their duty was to try to fill in any damage to an altarpiece or a painting. But in some senses, they could accidentally mislead the viewer into thinking that the original artist created something when it was in fact added by restorers. And sometimes their knowledge of chemistry was insufficient and they wound up damaging artworks that they were trying to save.
So there were concerns about paintings being physically dirty. Joseph II of the Holy Roman Empire had an entirely different context for thinking the painting was unacceptably dirty. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is one of the funnier incidents. This is Emperor Joseph II of Austria-Hungary, who is the Enlightenment patron of Beethoven and Mozart, and he ruled by reason alone. He thought that the human being was the greatest creation possible, and that the human capability of reason was what ennobled mankind. And he, like a good intellectual, went traveling to see the Ghent altarpiece because it was one of those absolute destinations for the educated traveler and the artist alike. And he arrived in 1781, and while he admired the painting, he found the two painted figures of Adam and Eve, which are on the far left and the far right of the Ghent altarpiece when it's opened. He found them to be too realistic. And the nude figure, in a classical sense, was perfectly acceptable. The sort of Hellenistic style nude that has no body hair, that has nothing that is too suggestive that this is a real person, that ennobles mankind because they're depicted as the ideal of beauty. That was fine. But Jan van Eyck's nude Adam and Eve are depicted with warts and nose hairs and everything you could possibly imagine, with unheroic level of naturalism that he found ignoble. And he actually, it's not clear if he specifically demanded that the that those two panels, at least, of the painting be censored, but the government of Ghent decided they didn't want to push their luck, and they actually removed those panels for storage, and a century later, they would be replaced by panels that were painted with bear skin covering all the naughty bits on the nude Adam and Eve.
Well, thank God they didn't take paint and brush to the original panels.
Exactly, but, you know, back then that was not unheard of, and I wouldn't have put it past them, so we did get lucky in that sense.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Noah Charney is my guest. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb. We'll go back to the phones now and speak with Aaron in Denton. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Okay, well, my question really is, what, if any, similarities do you find between the Nazis' stealing of great art during World War II and the sort of the looting that took place in the National Museum of Iraq in Baghdad during the American invasion in 2003 and the sort of recovery effort that's been going on since then? And sort of what hope do we have of recovering all these items that have been sort of siphoned off on the black market, and what the role of art historians is for the future to protect art from theft?
Well, that's an interesting question. The main distinction between the looting of the National Museum in Iraq and the Nazi looting was that the looting of the National Museum in Iraq seems to have been a crime of opportunity for a number of the looters, but there were also groups that we would describe as organized crime groups planning what they would steal if there was an anarchic situation that presented itself that would give them access to the works. And what they stole were antiquities, which, while they were cataloged, they weren't always cataloged with the degree of accuracy, the number of photos that would make it easy to track them down. And so when they go on the black market, looted antiquities are particularly difficult for authorities to track down. During the Second World War, most of the looting that took place was at an official policy level. The Nazis had a unit called the ERR, which was completely dedicated to the theft of art. After the Nazis, the Red Army, the Russian Army, did an incredible amount of looting in an attempt to steal art that the Nazis had stolen by way of reparations for the lives lost on the Russian front. That would be the main distinction. They're two absolutely devastating phenomena, and I can speak in a moment about the phenomenon of art crime today and how that functions. But what's interesting in the story of the Ghent altarpiece is that you have its theft in the Second World War, you have its theft in the First World War, and you also have its theft during the Napoleonic Wars. And Napoleon is really the first person who initiated the concept that when you sign an armistice as the defeated party against Napoleon, you are required to forfeit your cultural heritage and give it to Napoleon to enrich the holdings of France. And that began very early on during the Napoleonic era in 1796. And it's a policy that continues through the Second World War, despite the protestations of nations, and it's a very hot topic today, about who owns national patrimony and the cultural heritage of one nation and whether it should be permitted to reside outside the borders. So it brings up a number of these interesting questions.
And Napoleon wanted it, one, because he was never shy about taking what he thought belonged to France, but he wanted it in part because of its historical value as opposed to its artistic, aesthetic value.
He did. Napoleon had a bit of a funny taste in art. He liked things that were really big and really realistic. But he did have a henchman who is a very famous art historian, whose name is Denon, Dominique Vivant Denon, who was the first director of the Louvre Museum when it was converted from a palace. And Denon was advising Napoleon on what to steal. Napoleon would take the very big, realistic paintings for himself, and Denon would take the cream of the crop. Napoleon had established what is the first official military art theft unit that traveled with the French First Republican Army and then Imperial Army and stole the central panels of the Ghent altarpiece in 1794. We're not sure why they didn't also take the wing panels, because they could have. But they shipped the central panels back to the Louvre, and Woodenon realized that he had only gotten part of this masterpiece. This is the equivalent of getting, you know, the Venus de Milo minus the head. That he offered to swap paintings by Rubens, who he figured, you know, Rubens is from Antwerp. These guys live in Ghent. They're practically neighbors for the rest of the Ghent altarpiece. But by that time, the Ghent altarpiece had become really the battle standard for the country that would become Belgium. At that point was Flanders. It became a symbol, the possession of it was a symbol that they had held out against invaders, and it would become in the future the very first thing that any invading army would try to steal to prove their domination over the vanquished Flemish. So it was an issue that was struck up very early on, because this was one of the most famous paintings in the world. It's on any art historian's top 10 list of the most important paintings ever made, and therefore Denon directed Napoleon towards it.
How banged up did this thing get as it was being moved from place to place over the centuries?
Well, we don't have a really good report about the damage up until really the Second World War, when we know the extent of the damage in transport. But at this time, it seems to have been relatively well-preserved, because even back then, everyone knew that art was valuable because it was in a good condition that would raise its value, and that these were also seen as something that you wouldn't want to damage, you wouldn't want to destroy. What you'd want to do is steal it from the vanquished culture and bring it back as a trophy of war for display. It's almost like taking the severed head of a king and displaying it on battlements. And this shows your domination, but it doesn't show your domination if the object is greatly damaged, because it doesn't enrich you to the same extent as it would if the object's in great condition. So Napoleon actually had a professional, essentially art packing unit to accompany the art theft unit, because he made such a policy of this that he had in each armistice a clause that said, we get to choose X number of works of art from your kingdom, from your duchy, that we are going to seize. And then the kicker was, he required the defeated party to foot the bill to ship all the art back to Paris.
Noah Charney is with us. He's founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, the true story of the world's most coveted masterpiece. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art, Noah Charney. His newest book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, the true story of the world's most coveted masterpiece. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Noah, the Getty Museum has pledged to completely restore the Ghent altarpiece. Before we talk about the significance of that, can you explain what restoration of a painting of this nature means today?
Sure. Restoration has been stepped aside for conservation, which is the preferred term these days. The idea in the past was that conservators were essentially artists who would try to prevent a painting from deteriorating further, particularly keeping it in a controlled, humidity-controlled environment without too much light on it, and making sure that there were no, for instance, worms in the woodwork, if it's a panel painting or if it's a book, trying to make sure that it's pest-free and that it is in as controlled and consistent an environment as possible. This would also include, in the past, painting over portions that had been damaged at some point in history, perhaps through water damage, perhaps a portion was damaged in a fire. And the conservators would try to paint in such a way that it would be indistinguishable what they had done from the original, to try to reproduce it as best as possible. After the Second World War, there was a sea change in what conservators were trying to accomplish. What they try to do now is to simply mitigate damage, prevent damage from expanding, but they're very concerned about not inadvertently tricking the viewer into thinking that something that a modern conservator had added to a canvas is in fact part of the original. So they try to control the damage now, and they're trying to essentially clean a work and make sure that it is going to last another few hundred years and that there's nothing that is actively endangering the work at present.
Is the entire polyptych original that hangs today?
Well, what you see today, it's an interesting question, and according to official reports, 11 of the 12 panels are original. But there's a mystery that is based on one of the thefts of the Gendalt piece. It's actually just one of its panels, which is referred to as the Righteous Judges panel, the panel at the far bottom left when the polyptych is open, that was stolen in 1934. And there's some question as to whether that panel is still missing or has actually been surreptitiously reinserted into the Ghent altarpiece and is present even today.
So explain why somebody would have had this stolen piece and then put it back.
Well, the theft itself is particularly bizarre and labyrinthine, but the short version of the story is that in 1934, one of the panels disappeared, this judge's panel, and a note was left at the crime scene saying, "Taken from Germany by the Treaty of Versailles." And this is important in world history because the Ghent altarpiece was one of only a few cultural objects that were specifically listed in the Treaty of Versailles, which was the treaty that ended the First World War. And it stated that the Ghent altarpiece had to be returned to Belgium from Germany. And at that point, part of it was in Germany, and part of it was still in Belgium.
And the Germans were furious about having to surrender this.
The Germans were furious particularly because they actually hadn't managed to steal the entire altarpiece, which is particularly funny. I had mentioned earlier that in 1816, this renegade vicar stole the wing panels of the altarpiece, and through a series of sales, it wound up in Berlin at the Kaiser Friedrich Museum. And those were the panels that were returned via the Treaty of Versailles. Now, Germans hadn't actually stolen the wing panels. This renegade vicar had, and it went through four different transactions before it ended up in Germany. And yet, after the First World War, they were forced to return these panels as if they had stolen them during the war. Now, they tried to steal the rest during the war, and there was another adventure that the Ghent altarpiece went through during the First World War when it was almost stolen on a number of occasions, and it narrowly escaped a kidnap thanks to the wiles of the local canon of the Cathedral of St. Bavon, who almost single-handedly hid and shepherded the Ghent altarpiece through a series of dramatic hiding places during the First World War. But because this note was pinned to the crime scene all the way in 1934, people thought that the theft was an act of German nationalism. It in fact turned out to be a red herring, but the police got nowhere with the investigation. The investigation was botched in a number of different ways. It smacked of conspiracy to a lot of people. And then, several months after the theft, when the police were nowhere nearer finding the criminal, there was a stockbroker who was at a political rally in a suburb of Ghent, and he collapsed of a heart attack. He was brought to his in-law's house to recover. He called his lawyer. He spoke to his lawyer alone for 15 minutes. His last words were, "I'm the last person on earth who knows the location of the stolen judges panel." And then with perfect cinematic timing, he died without saying anything else about it. And it led police to investigate into the background of this potential criminal. But people still thought that he couldn't have been acting alone, and he had no evident motivation for stealing the panel because he was a rich man. And this links back to what I spoke about at the beginning of the show with the theory that the Ghent altarpiece is a secret coded treasure map leading to the Arma Christi, and that for this reason the Nazis wanted to capture it. Some people think that this one panel, the judge's panel, was stolen by this stockbroker and his colleagues to try to keep a key piece of that treasure map out of Nazi hands.
So this panel that was supposed to have been a copy might in fact be the original panel?
Yes, this is the odd coda to the story. The police gave up the investigation officially before the First World War, and they determined that this stockbroker must have acted alone, which actually goes against logic when we investigate the case more closely, and that the a Ghent altarpiece is entirely intact, but this one panel is still missing. And it's very much alive in the citizens of Ghent today and in Belgians in general. In 2008, there was an anonymous police tip that the judges panel was buried under the floorboards of a house in Ghent, and police ripped up the floorboards and they didn't find it, but it's evidence that it's still very much in the mindset of Belgians. And yet, there's this funny coda to the story. When the case was officially deemed closed and the panel still considered missing, a conservator called Jef van der Wecken began painting an exact duplicate of the judges panel that he painted, he said, on a 17th century cupboard panel that was the exact right size, and he painted in an absolutely astonishing semblance of Van Eyck's work, and he made just a few changes that indicated that this is his work and not the original. And this panel was bought by the Belgian government and installed after the Second World War in the Ghent altarpiece. So when you go to visit the Ghent altarpiece today, the official word is that you're seeing 11 panels by Van Eyck and one by this conservator, Jef van der Wecken. And yet, in 1974, 30 years after the panel was painted, a conservator whose job it was to clean the Ghent altarpiece every year suddenly showed up one year and he did a double take. And all of a sudden, he was absolutely convinced that the judges panel had aged by about 500 years in the last year since he had cleaned the altarpiece. And he saw what he thought was the Jan van Eyck original. And he called a friend to check it out who was also a conservator, and they agreed that the crackler, which is the web of cracks in the surface of paint that comes through changes in humidity over time, looked identical to the rest of the altarpiece, not like something that had just been painted 30 years before. The bishopric did a scientific investigation, and they announced, unfortunately, this is the replacement copy. But they refused to publish any scientific information about the investigation, which led some people to think that, in fact, the bishopric may have been involved in the 1934 theft. Well, that's the question that hangs still to this day. Is that panel the original Van Eyck that was somehow painted over by the conservator van der Wecken in order to reinstall it into the Ghent altarpiece to essentially cover up the crime, but perhaps it was painted with a very thin layer of paint that after 30 years of exposure to light had faded, and what the conservator was seeing was the original painting ghosting through the surface? Or, in fact, was that conservator mistaken? Was the bishopric being honest, and is this, unfortunately, the copy by Jef van der Wecken? Well, now that the Getty Conservation Institute is doing a complete restoration with the Belgian government, it's ongoing. I was in Ghent recently, and they're still working on it. Hopefully, when they publish their findings, we'll get an answer to that question.
How would they prove it one way or another?
Well, it would be relatively easy to prove just by the age of the paint. There's an incredible amount of technology that can be used to date works of art now. You can also test chemically and make sure that the paints used are consistent with the time period that it's purportedly painted from. They'd be able to tell the difference between a 15th century piece of oak and a 17th century piece of oak. And also you can do x-rays and see if there's underdrawing. You may have heard of the term pentimenti. This means ghosts of original paintings or underdrawings that eventually may shine through when the top layer of paint fades, and what you get is this kind of ghosted image coming through on the surface. Well, you can see these pentimenti with an x-ray, see the original lines and designs that an artist may have begun with, and then altered their plan of how the painting should work as they were painting, and then eventually you see what's on the surface, but the x-rays can see the various steps beneath. Well, an x-ray should be able to tell us, and the official line is still that this is unfortunately the copy and that we should still keep our eyes open for the judges panel, but we'll get a full report hopefully next year when the Getty Conservation Institute publishes their findings.
So, Noah, you have dedicated your career to art crime, and a lot of people may not realize we think of this in a sort of romantic way, but in fact, this is one of the, according to Interpol, one of the greatest crime businesses in the world.
It is. I study art crime as well as art history, and the art crime is particularly interesting because it tends to be misunderstood not only by the general public, but by police and governments as well. The U.S. Department of Justice says that art crime is the third highest grossing criminal trade every year, behind only the drugs and arms trade, which is absolutely astonishing but gives you a sense of the extent of it. And one of the other problems is that since the Second World War, most art crime is involved in some point in the life of the crime with international organized crime syndicates. And because of that, the stolen painting that we may think is entertaining, it certainly is entertaining and fun to read about, is actually far more sinister than we imagine, and is funding and fueling all manner of other crimes in which organized crime is involved, including the drugs and arms trade and even terrorism.
And a lot of law enforcement agencies don't treat this any differently than if someone came into my house and stole my TV.
It's true. Most police departments are told by their administration to file stolen art with general stolen property. And you can imagine how a Rembrandt painting is different from a DVD player. And yet they tend to be filed together. And as a result, we have very poor data about the true extent of art crime. But what's telling is the data that we do have indicates that, yes, indeed, it is a very severe crime type. And yet people don't take it seriously because we have this residual concept of what art crime consists of that's perpetuated through, unfortunately, media misrepresentations and then also fiction and film. We have this Victorian concept of art crime. Art crime in the Victorian period, in general, was not involved with organized crime. It was individual thieves stealing art for often ideological or nationalistic reasons as much as financial ones. They were crimes of dexterity. They were rarely violent. And there was something to be admired in some of them, particularly by those who feel that art is for the elite and is somehow other, and that people who are committing crimes against the elite are sort of Robin Hood-like figures. That was the case in the pre-World War II period, but since the Second World War, with the rise of international organized crime groups ranging from small local gangs to large international syndicates have effectively taken over art crime, which is the looting of antiquities and the theft of works of art from extant collections, smuggling of it and turning it into profit, not always through sale, but sometimes through barter and collateral between other criminal groups for other illicit goods like drugs or arms, or stealing it for ransom. And it is an incredibly widespread problem. We tend to think of it as, you know, a few museum heists that make the headlines each year, but in fact, there's between 50 and 100,000 reported art thefts per year, and that's only what's reported, which is a fragment of what we have a sense is actually going on.
So we just have about 30 seconds left, but I wonder if you can tell us, do you have a favorite panel in the Ghent altarpiece?
I would have to say my favorite panel is The Righteous Judges, because it has such a crazy story, of which I've given you just a slight preview. But it has so much loaded into it, from the idea that it's the key part of this treasure map that the Nazis were hunting, to its theft in 1934, to the self-portrait of Jan van Eyck and perhaps of his brother Hubert that may be found inside the work. I would say that is my favorite.
Noah Charney is founding director of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb, The True Story of the World's Most Coveted Masterpiece. Noah, it's a fascinating book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.